I'm not a lawyer. I just need to say that I asked one of my professors about coming to speak to y'all because it's basically illegal for me to give legal advice or tell the legal consequences of actions, and he said to tell everyone I'm not a lawyer and just present everything as research, and that would pretty much cover me. So, and just be careful what I say and don't say. If you do this, then this will happen. So that's part of why I do this so much, because I do want to become a lawyer, and I don't want to do anything that'll prevent that from happening now. I want to talk about evidence and law enforcement and the Fifth Amendment, and after listening to people talk here at the conference, I decided maybe it would be a good thing to talk a little bit also about the First Amendment and what exactly constitutes freedom of speech and how that relates to things that you say and code that you write and things that you put out in public. So I'll start with the law enforcement and the evidence aspect of things. The handout that I gave out is just it's a list of contacts in federal law enforcement that I didn't really want to spend a lot of time talking about, and it's stuff that you could easily find yourself, but it's some resources that you can use in case you have an attack. But one thing I want to point out about the FBI is, you probably already know this, but they really don't deal with things that are less than $5,000 of damage, or unless there's a sniffer installed, because the sniffer implicates the wiretap law. So they consider that something that they'll deal with, even if the damage is not very much. But with the $5,000, they'd like you to contact them anyway if it's something that might have happened to more than one company, because they'll add them together. So if they do $500 at your company and $500 at another, pretty soon it adds up to $5,000. So they would like you to contact them. Part of the problem with contacting the FBI is, after you turn your information over to them, chances are they're not going to tell you anything else ever again. And part of that is because they're not allowed to talk about pending investigations. That's part of the laws governing the FBI, is they're not allowed to divulge certain types of information. And part of it is just the way they look at the world. They think that the less things that people know about everything, the better. So they're just not going to share information with you. So you're probably better off, if you have some kind of intrusion or security breach, dealing with your local law enforcement, which would be your state level or your county or whatever local law enforcement that you have in your area that's set up to deal with technology crimes or white-collar crime. Most of the time, at least in California, all the computer crime units are underneath the heading of white-collar crime. So if you're looking for it in the phone book, that's where you might want to look. And what you want to do is contact them before you have a problem and introduce yourself, tell them who you are, what company you represent. And that way, when you do have a problem and you want them to come investigate, they already know who you are, and they're not going to spend a bunch of time doing a background check on you or doubting that it's serious. It's much better if you develop the relationship beforehand. And that'll help expedite things when you do need to talk to law enforcement. Do you have a question?
Yeah. But say that I'm just a small business, and I got hacked, and I lost a lot of money, but since I'm a small business, it's only something like maybe $3,000 or something like that, like a really small amount. How do I convince law enforcement to help me out? You know, when I'm a small guy, there's no, like, leads or busts in their future if they find out the hacked.
Well, if you're talking about the feds, they will listen to you, but they'll take your information, but they're not going to communicate back with you. But with the local law enforcement, they probably will want to. I don't know about this state, but in California, they want to keep track of those things so that they can propose legislation. They want to. You need to come prepared to develop a relationship with them and say, you know, I know this is only X amount of damage, but this person probably hit other people, or this affects this many customers, or just have some argument prepared for them on why they should help you. I think that the local law enforcement, the state or local law enforcement, is going to want to help you even if it's a minuscule amount of damage, because you are a business. You probably have a couple employees. That is in their best interest.
But say that I was looking at my logs, and I know I got hacked by, say, like, from something originating at mobsters.net in the middle of Ohio.
Uh-huh.
What is California going to be able to do about that?
Now, that's why you need to look up your local law enforcement. I mean, you probably have something in this state. You probably have some white-collar crime unit here, and they're probably used to dealing with embezzling or stuff like that, and the amount of damage from embezzling isn't that different from if somebody compromises your data. That's
but going back to my question, I live in California. I got hacked from Ohio. What are the California people going to be able to do about those Ohio motherfuckers who just hacked my shit, you know?
Oh, well, most states have reciprocity, so if the white-collar crime unit in your state will just contact the other state and they'll work something out. Okay. So, as I was saying, it's probably important for you to contact these people beforehand, know what you're going to say to them, and also it's important, in order to be able to talk to law enforcement about the amount of damage that was done, you should know what it is that your company thinks is so valuable that they're willing to pay you a salary to work there. There must be something that they are paying you to protect, right? If they're paying you for security, they're paying you to protect something. Know what that is and know what kind of damage could be done to it and know how to figure out what the dollar value of the damage is before the security breach happens, so that you don't have to sit there and try and figure it out right in the middle of everything. What you want to do, if you on one of those pages, there's an FBI checklist for what to do if you have an intrusion. But it basically just comes down to planning beforehand. And the one thing that they recommend the most is have something secure that logs all the system commands, so that it's not something that would be part of the security breach, that's sort of a backup system. And then if you do detect some kind of compromise to your security, they recommend that you forget about preserving evidence and make your system secure, protect your data, protect whatever it is that you want to protect, and then worry about collecting evidence later. And then once you've made your system secure, what they want you to do is isolate all your equipment. Don't turn it off, just isolate it. Call them and wait for them to show up and image your entire network or system, which is, I mean, that's, if you're a business, that's kind of ridiculous, right? You can't really do that, because somebody needs that system. They're using it for a purpose, or they wouldn't even own it in the first place. So if you're not going to do that, they would like you to get all the logs and print them out or copy them to removable media so that they can take that with them. Just preserve as much evidence as you can. And they want you to also keep track of everything that you do, because it's going to become important later in the court case, if there ever is one, that you be able to tell what it is that you did as opposed to what it is that the other person did. So if you come in and somebody's in your system and you're going to take measures to kick them off and make your system secure, you need to keep track of what commands you enter and what you do, so that you can say in court, okay, this is me, this is the cracker, this is me, this is the cracker, because otherwise their defense is just going to be, well, I didn't do those things. They can't prove who did. So you need to keep track of what it is that you're doing. They also recommend that you not tell anyone else in your company that you've had an intrusion or a security breach, because a lot of them come from the inside. And so if you tell somebody, hey, you know, somebody's messing around in our system, you might be talking to the person who's doing it. That's what they say. So they'd like you to not tell anyone except them. That's the FBI. Of course, you probably know your coworkers, and you probably know who you can talk to. So, but once again, you do want to keep track of who knows what, who said what to whom, who did what. And then you just turn the evidence over to law enforcement. And it's important to keep track of who's had access to it. The best thing is you just turn your logs directly over to law enforcement, and they'll do what they want with it. But if you can't do that for some reason, at least keep track of exactly how many people have had custody of it. Yeah. There's sort of a presumption that victims won't falsify logs. And so in the case you're talking about, that presumption works against the innocent party. But there is sort of a presumption that whatever evidence is gathered by the victim of a crime and turned over to law enforcement has not been tampered with by them. And that's all you really need, is just to say, here are my logs. And they can, you know, if they want to trace it back and do all that, that's going to be up to them, and it's going to be up to the other organization to prove that they didn't do it. They're going to have to, I mean, they're the ones that are going to have to provide their logs showing that you intruded on their system and hacked yourself from them.
Yeah, but I don't read hacks, or I don't leave logs.
You what? Okay, well, in that case, there's probably going to be a miscarriage of justice. I mean, there is a presumption. Juries are just going to assume that the victim didn't falsify the logs.
Excellent.
I think that is my next... There are two issues with evidence, really. One is getting the evidence into court, just getting it admitted as authentic. And all that really takes with documents is somebody saying, yeah, I work for company X. Those are the logs off the computer during this time period. They're authentic. I mean, it's pretty simple. And so the evidence comes in, right? But the evidence could be totally false. So the jury is supposed to tell the truth from the falsehood. And that's part of why you have witnesses on the stand to authenticate documents. They're supposed to watch you talking and decide if you're lying or not. And that's the basis of the jury factor. I mean, they could believe you or they could not believe you. If you're a convincing liar and you falsified the logs, somebody might get in trouble. And it's going to be up to them and their attorney to come up with the evidence to show that they didn't do it. And so you can't discount the jury factor, because they don't really probably understand the technology. So they're going to be watching your face when you authenticate that log and trying to determine if you're lying or not. I mean, that's the way our criminal justice system works. So in your hypothetical situation, it kind of comes down to the jury factor, which is how good a liar is NFF. But, I mean, I guess that's just the way it is with our criminal justice system. Yeah.
Assuming that I would otherwise completely falsify logs to prove that someone hated.
No, wait, what? I'm not understanding the question. How can you,
I mean, in court, how much credence do they give to chain of custody questions like that? How much credence would a jury give to chain of custody? Like saying, like, this is a box which has not been touched by any. Everything that's on it absolutely has to be authentic. Let me try to say, like, in vain. How is that better in court than this pile of logs, which I swear to you, are absolutely correct?
Okay. If you're talking about criminal liability, if they access something that's unauthorized, you set something up that's attractive, that you want people to break into, that you don't care if they break into it other than that you don't want them to break into something else, right? It's still unauthorized access. And so it's still a violation of the criminal law. So it doesn't really matter what your motive was in putting that there or how valuable it was to you under the criminal law, because it doesn't really depend on, except for the federal laws, it doesn't really depend on the dollar value damage. It just says, you know, most of the laws just say unauthorized access. So if it's an area of your, let's say it's part of something you have on the internet and you don't, it's password protected and you don't want people in there and they break in anyway, then that's unauthorized access. And so it doesn't really matter what your motive for putting it there was. Does that answer your question?
No, I was asking about the chain of custody and reference.
Well, it's just the same as anything else. You just say, this is a secure area of my website and people aren't supposed to look at it, and they did, and they did this while they were in there. And
right, but how do I go to a jury and say, I left this box on my network to intentionally catch hackers?
But you don't need to say that. If it's unauthorized access and it's a violation of a criminal law, you don't need to say that you left it on there purposefully to catch hackers. I mean, you could tell them that.
Well, as opposed to having a bunch of logs which are presumed to be true, even though there's no absolute way of authenticating the fact that they're true.
It sounds to me like you're asking what a jury would think about that evidence. And, I mean, you're probably in just as good a position to judge that as I am. They're juries. They're just people. So think about what, like, pretend like your mom is sitting there and you're trying to explain all this to her. What would she think? I mean, everybody's a good judge of juries because everybody knows someone who's not completely comfortable with the technology that they could try to explain things to and see what they thought. So if you want to know what a jury would think, find someone in your family who's not really an expert and try to explain it to them and see what they think, and that'll tell you what the jury will probably think. Does that answer your question? Okay, all right. Maybe I should just stop answering your questions.
You do have candy, correct?
Yeah, but I'm not giving it until the Q&A section.
No,
I'll throw candy at you later. So does anybody besides NFF have a question about evidence? Yeah.
government's did a few things when they take. They said they could educate the computer, take a notebook for handwriting evidence, whatnot, and some other stuff. But they also took four glass pieces and a bunch of weapons and brought them out to the vehicles. And they brought them back in and just thought, like, oh, we don't need this. And isn't there like a camp do lock? If there's drugs sitting out there, don't they have to do something about it?
I kind of went over the that yesterday, but there is, if you're talking about the plain view doctrine, that's sort of an exception to the Fourth Amendment protections that says that anything that you put out in the public view is not protected by Fourth Amendment protections. So, but you're asking, if they see something, don't they have to do something, right? I don't know about, I mean, that would be a matter of the police department's internal policy on whatever it is that you had. Maybe they don't consider whatever kind of weapons that you had. Well, maybe you should just consider yourself lucky that they decided to ignore all that stuff.
Oh, what else did they do? In the morning, they have to have skating in the morning, they have to come up with like a area of the house.
Generally, with a warrant, what you're talking about is a scope of the warrant issue. And generally, when they get a warrant, they have to say person or place to be searched and whatever they're going to seize. And what they usually do is they say, this person is suspected of being involved in this crime and we want to search this place. And usually it's the whole house and everything attached to it, including the garage and the shed and all that kind of stuff. So also if you have roommates and the police knock on the door and say, can I come in? And your roommates say, oh, yeah, sure, come on in. I think if they gave you a receipt and there were items that you know that they took that were missing from the receipt, I would, if it was me, just sort of, I would contact the police department and say they also took these other items. Try to get a receipt for them. I was going to ask if there were any audience volunteers who want to talk about interactions with the police, and but not if you're currently on probation or you have something pending, because it's probably not a good idea to talk about it. All right. I didn't get any take. Oh, you.
I'm quite middle class. I mean, they don't even look at me if I can talk about it if you want.
Have you been arrested? No?
No.
Did
I was able to talk my way out of anything.
I was just going to ask, would you have a police investigation?
Well, are you law enforcement and you want to?
No, I'm not law enforcement. I've worked with law enforcement before.
Yeah.
Go on up. Jan Tiel.
Yeah, come on up. You get the good candy. You get the little chocolate shaped like NASCARs for that. I'm going to sort of Any questions about evidence or authenticating it or getting it into court or anything like that? Okay. I'm going to sort of move on to Fifth Amendment rights, and that is the Fifth Amendment is has the privilege against self-incrimination, and the protections afforded by it, the Supreme Court experimented with a few different things, and what we have now is the Miranda warning. So has everyone heard the Miranda warning? You know what's involved with that? Okay, how many people have seen the TV show Cops and seen people been Mirandized, and then the next words out of their mouth are, after they hear the Miranda warning, right, and then they say, but I didn't hit her that hard, or, you know, that's Jimmy's knife, not mine, or, you know, they've been told to be silent, and the next thing out of their mouth is something totally incriminating, and you see it every time. And so in some sense, the Miranda warning is, it's lost if nobody pays attention to it. And the best word I can give you on that is listen to what they're saying. And if they say you have a right, don't ignore it. Don't waive it. Say, I want a lawyer. If you're arrested, what you want to do is don't open your mouth unless it's to say, I want a lawyer. So in your dealings with law enforcement, you've been assisting them in investigating crimes?
Yes.
And have you provided evidence to them?
Yes.
And so what kind of authentication did they ask you for?
In terms of who I am or in terms of the evidence?
In terms of the evidence itself.
It had to be documented very well, actually, about the chain of command, the chain of who's had contact with it, who's worked with it, what kind of work's been done with it, especially with computer crimes, given the ease of fraudulent of making data up in terms of, you know, oh, this was a log entry that I created 3 months after the fact, but if I put it in the right place in the logs, it looks correct, things like that. So
how many people generally would have had access to the logs before you turned it over to law enforcement?
About a half dozen, actually. Two administrators and about two or three of us involved in the investigation on site before it got to law enforcement.
And so then how did they want the information in written form? Did they just interview you, or?
They definitely wanted very, very well documented in terms of a chain of custody of the evidence and what had been done with it, what had transpired with the actual physical evidence.
Had you kept notes of everything that you did?
Yep.
So while the incident was going on, you wrote down, you know, your name and the time and what you did?
Actually, it turns out we didn't keep good enough notes. That's actually one of the more interesting things about it, you know, is that we thought that we had been documented to a pretty good degree. But in terms of what law enforcement needs and in terms of what the law provides for dismissing evidence, we hadn't done enough.
So what was it that was missing that they wanted that you forgot to do?
Just very detailed logs in terms of timestamps, in terms of exact descriptions of what we had done, and minimizing the chain of custody of the evidence and ensuring that it was at all times protected from outside tampering.
So did they tell you to call them quicker next time?
this is actually what's really sad about it. So they didn't really seem to give too much of a hoot about it. We found a ring of about 100 to 200 machines, including government machines, that had been compromised. And had very clear evidence of those activities, and they could care less.
Were you dealing with federal officials? Or
yes.
Okay. Did you try contacting the state white-collar crime unit or anything like that?
Given the fact that we found evidence of only one or two machines within our state, it didn't really seem to be that big of a deal to us. But the fact that it had stretched internationally was why we contacted federal authorities.
Did they ever check back with you and tell you that there was going to be a prosecution or there wasn't, or?
Yes, actually, a few days later we talked more about it, and it turns out that they were very uninterested in prosecuting it because of the way the evidence had been handled, essentially. We'd handled some of the best, but it wasn't good enough for law enforcement. I mean, it takes a lot of prep, I mean, really, to be educated about how to handle evidence for law enforcement.
So the main thing that was missing from what you provided to them was you hadn't kept track of exactly what time you did everything, and you also allowed too many people to get involved in
we couldn't have guaranteed the way we had been handling the evidence that we were the only ones who were, had access to it, and had access to it, rather. So our definition of forensic evidence as security investigators was significantly different than theirs. I mean, our standards were much lower than theirs were. So, but then again, we're not taking it into a court. We're not having our evidence challenged legally. And so, I mean, there's still a lot of rights as a defendant that you can have a lot of evidence thrown out. So I learned that lesson pretty quickly, I guess.
Okay. So what you're hearing from him, someone who's actually done with it, dealt with it, is a little bit different from the information I got from law enforcement. They said that just keep track of everything. And I guess that's part of their... they said that we often don't prosecute, but they didn't make it clear. They tried to make it sound like they often don't prosecute because it's not worth it, but it sounds like they told you that you mishandled the evidence and that's why they weren't interested.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, in terms of our hands mishandling it as well as other hands mishandling it, it just wasn't. And then in terms of, I think, the damage, as far as they were concerned, was pretty minimal. No lives had been put in danger. No interstate commerce had been threatened. There was no physical damage of machines. It was just a matter of paying us to clean it up. And
had there been sniffers installed?
Yes.
Because they also try to make it sound like that's something that they'll always want to deal with.
They could have cared less, actually, about the sniffer. But given the fact that this machine and others in the collection of them had shut down, I think, one university's networking for 2 or 3 days, you know, that was a pretty serious disruption, I think, to not a business, but an enterprise of some sort. But wasn't enough for them to get interested enough.
Great. Well, thanks for that then. So also, if you want to get training from the feds on how to handle evidence, the National White Collar Crime Center is having a conference in Los Angeles next month. I have some brochures on it, and they will give you detailed training. They also have a webpage that's on that resource list I handed out, and if you contact them, they'll probably help you get training, even if it's just referring you to resources. But
no, I think those are very good points. I was actually going to recommend that before things happen, you should have your staff legally trained in terms of what constitutes a time to contact law enforcement and how to handle evidence, how to prepare evidence, things like that, how to have good contact set up. I think those are very good points.
They do say call them right away, limit the number of people, don't tell a lot of people, and log everything and keep track of exactly what you do and when. Yeah?
Okay. Pretty much, yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
Appreciate that. It looks like people are coming in for the next speech, but we have a few more minutes. I want to talk briefly about the Fifth Amendment and your rights. I already kind of mentioned it a little bit, but just remember, you don't want to talk to law enforcement if you're a suspect unless your lawyer is present. And you have to ask for the lawyer, and then if you do anything that is reopening the investigation, then there was a case where a gentleman had been arrested and he'd been read his rights, and he said he wanted to not speak to them and that he wanted a lawyer. But then at some point he said, "What's going to happen to me next?" And the Supreme Court said that he reopened the investigation and waived his rights by saying, "What's going to happen to me next?" I mean, he might have been wondering when he was going to get to go to the bathroom next, but they said, no, he was inquiring about the investigation, and therefore everything that he said was admissible as a confession. And so what you want to do is say, "I want a lawyer," and don't say anything else. Probably if you say, "Can I go to the bathroom? Can I smoke a cigarette? Can I make a phone call?" that would probably be okay, but you probably don't want to say anything else because the Supreme Court is pretty... they're pretty willing to say that something is reopening the investigation, and once you do that, it's considered a waiver of your Fifth Amendment rights. Yeah?
Do I have the right to ask to speak with the district attorney? Not say anything until the district attorney shows up? Because I want to get, like, the best deal possible. I know the cops don't have the authority to give it to me. Like, I want to give away all of my friends because I hate jail that much. Do I have the right to ask the district attorney and not say anything until he shows up?
Your rights are contained in the Bill of Rights. So when they say privilege against self-incrimination, that just refers to, it's basically a right not to have a confession beat out of you. I mean, it doesn't include demanding that the district attorney show up so you can make deals. What you really want to do is ask for your lawyer, right? Have the lawyer make the deals. You don't want to be talking to the DA. All right. Okay. The Miranda warning comes when you're having a custodial interrogation. And the definition of custody is when they've significantly impeded your freedom. So it's kind of a fine line. There are factors that they consider. Just walking up and talking to you is not a custodial interrogation. If they call you and ask you to come down to the police station and you voluntarily go down there, that is not a custodial investigation. But if they call you and ask you to come down there and then lock the door and tell you you can't leave, then that probably is a custodial investigation. So your best bet is to say, you know, I think I want my lawyer. Don't say I think. Be more indefinite. Just say, I want a lawyer. And don't say anything else. Because if you're a potential suspect, you need your lawyer there when you're talking to them.
If I ask, am I under arrest?
Uh-huh.
And they don't answer.
Oops, that was wild. Sorry about that. Oh.
I got one. It's fine. It's
okay.
Fine.
But I like throwing things at people. Yeah.
If I ask, am I under arrest, and they don't significantly answer, but I have already been locked in the room, and they've not Mirandized me, or even if I'm locked in a room and they tell me, no, we're just asking you some questions, and they haven't Mirandized me, Am I liable to self-incrimination at that point?
Well, part of the problem with, you don't know what they're planning to use that information for. They could be planning to use that against someone else.
But I'm locked up. And, okay, maybe I happen to know that Nick was doing horrible, evil, disgusting things. But if I might have been doing them as well, and they might be trying to get Nick, but, oh yeah, I saw Nick swipe those credit cards. In fact, I got a meal out of it too. I've just incriminated myself as an accessory, and I was never Mirandized. Can I be prosecuted on that basis?
Yeah, you can be, but there's always that the fruit of the poison tree doctrine does come into play. If they should have Mirandized you, and they didn't, they can't use what came out of your mouth to prosecute you, but that doesn't mean that they can't have independent evidence that they use. And so, once again, I would say, if you think you're a potential suspect, even if you didn't personally do anything, you want to have a lawyer present when you're talking to law enforcement. I mean, it just applies. If you might be a suspect, ask for a lawyer or bring your lawyer with you. Whoops. Yeah, you back there? He makes an important point. My sister was involved with an incident where she was basically harboring a fugitive from federal prison. And the FBI showed up along with the local sheriff, and they had their guns drawn, and they started questioning her without Mirandizing her. And she told them everything, and the FBI, but when she told me about it, she said, but it's okay, because the FBI said they weren't going to prosecute me. And that's a common myth. They don't have the authority to make that kind of deal, right? Just like he just said, the only person who has the authority to say, I won't prosecute you for a federal crime is the U.S. attorney, the federal prosecutors. So don't. If law enforcement is telling you that they're not going to prosecute you, that's just a ploy they use to get a confession out of you. They'll say, we're going to go after Nick. We're not going after you, so you can tell us everything, and we promise we won't prosecute you. That's part of why you need a lawyer present, right? Because the lawyer is going to protect you and say, you know, hey, you're not the DA. I know who you are. You're the law enforcement. You don't have that power to make those kind of deals.
Actually, I do have a quick question for you on that note.
She actually got one.
Yeah. Years ago, I learned through some sort of an effort to educate people about their rights that you should ask. There are two questions if you're approached by the cops you should ask. Am I under arrest? And am I under investigation for a crime? That second one, I think, is often not asked by people. Is that a good question to ask? Am I under investigation? Because you do have certain rights if you are under investigation.
You know, my criminal procedure teacher said, just like, don't. She used to be a defense attorney, and she said, have your lawyer present. I mean, because they can tell you anything. They can say, oh, well, we're not investigating you right now, right? But that doesn't mean that they're not going to in the future. And some of the criminal laws that are on the books right now, you might have broken the law and you don't know it. Like, if you look at an area of a government website that they don't want you to look at, even if there's no security on it, maybe they just don't have the link posted anywhere publicly, and you look at it, you're violating federal law. If they didn't intend for, it's their intention that you don't look at it, and they don't have any security on it, you've violated the federal law. So, you know, you don't know, you might not even have done anything that you think is wrong, and they might have you under investigation. So, once again, just call a lawyer, or ask for your lawyer that they're supposed to provide to you free of charge if you're under, if you're being interrogated.
And they know, just by talking to everybody and all of the tape, and all of these guys have been tape recording their phone conversations in the past 3 months. They know that I speak perfectly good English. The cops show up to my house, and I start speaking nothing but Spanish. And since these cops are, like, typical Michigan cops with no sense of culture, they read me my Miranda rights in English. And they say, yeah, we know this motherfucker understands English, so, you know, we're just going to read them to him in English and then, you know, keep on saying shit. Then they bring in a translator, and the translator starts interrogating him. And just to fuck with him, I tell him, yeah, I rooted everything that they said that I rooted, you know, this is how I did it and all this other stuff. In court, if they can prove that I know English, that I understand English, and that they Mirandize me in English, but I said everything in Spanish at the time, and the cops were working on the presumption that, yeah, this guy's speaking nothing but Spanish. Am I in the clear? Did I just totally fuckstore the cops? By the way, this actually happened to me, so I won't
All right, well, you get the first dum-dum for hearing your rights and ignoring them. Yeah. You know, if you're asking me, I actually don't know the answer to that question. If I would guess, because my teacher didn't talk about that, and I would guess that if they could prove that you knew English, then you kind of be out of luck with asserting that you didn't understand what they were saying.
But he confessed
in
Spanish.
But with Miranda rights, they say, like, have you understood these rights? Have you, you know, right. do you understand these rights? And if they don't speak Spanish, and I just say, no, no entiendo, which, you know, in Spanish means I don't understand. And I've told them, that, like, I've tried to do the best that I can in my life to say that I don't, well.
Yeah, but you speak English, right?
Right. No, but aren't I, am I still Mirandized if I've said, if I haven't acknowledged
the
fact
that
they've read my Miranda rights?
It's my understanding that you don't even necessarily have to acknowledge your Miranda.
Yeah. If you open, like the guy who said, what's going to happen to me next, that was considered a waiver, according to my teacher. So, I mean, you don't have to say, yes, I understood that, and I, you know, waive my rights. They're going to be really lenient with saying, they say, if you reopen the investigation by talking about it, you've said, yeah, I understood the rights, but I'm waiving them. You know, I don't really know the answer to your question because it's not something that we covered in school, and so it would be sort of me just sort of guessing. So, but I would guess that you'd be out of luck.
Okay, well,
but I think people are filing in for the next speech, so.
Well, we haven't got the speaker yet, so we have to stretch.
Okay. All right.
Well, just another thing. Let's say that the cop has the Spanish translation on the back of it.
Uh-huh.
And he tries to read it.
Uh-huh.
And he says, you have the right to a chicken sandwich.
Uh-huh.
Anything that you fuck can and will be used against you at your mom's house. And, like, and I can prove him that he completely fucked up the translation on the back side. He's not read my Miranda rights to me in Spanish. He has to operate under the assumption that for whatever reason I'm not speaking English to him. Do those Miranda rights still count?
You can't prove that. Yeah, by the time he got into court, he would speak Spanish
very well.
Better than him.
No, but if on the tape or on the transcript of this, they have him as...
What tape?
Huh?
What tape? What transcript?
My interrogation was taped. My interrogation was taped and, you know, this, like...
But they Mirandized you in English, right?
Huh? Actually, they didn't. But in this case, they didn't. They Mirandized me in Spanish, and they brought in a translator from Spain and said, yeah, that guy said you have the right to a chicken sandwich.
Well, I don't know about that.
And if they say that to me in Spanish, can I ask for a chicken sandwich?
All right, now you're just blatantly, you're changing the hypothetical just to mess with me. So you don't even get dum-dums now.
Are you going to start throwing blunt objects at me now? Josh, stop looking for blunt objects.
If we really have time, does anybody want to talk about the First Amendment and freedom of speech? Because... I've been hearing a lot of people talking about that, and I don't know how much y'all know about that. Did you have something to say?
Intellectual property is the one that I'm really interested
in. Okay. What is it that you want to know about IP? Because I haven't had that class yet, but I'm in the IP club. And the thing about IP, there are some common myths about it. I've heard some of them here. I'm trying to remember what they are. Things like
fair use.
Fair use does not apply to probably anybody sitting in this room. I mean, it's... there are all these myths floating around like, I changed it. So, you know, I took somebody's photograph and I made a few changes to it so it's not copyrighted. Or I found it on the internet and so it must be in public domain. Or, you know, it... I'm a student, and so everything I do is fair use. That it just doesn't work that way. Fair use is a very limited doctrine that it's intended for research, and you're not supposed to... I haven't actually had the class yet, but I know that there are these myths out there. And if you want to use something, like, has anybody heard that if anything is from before 1926, it's in public domain now? Because that's not true either. they can renew the copyrights. There are all kinds of myths about it. So your best bet is to look it up yourself. It's not that hard to find out what the real rules are. I have this ISP liability survival guide, and there's some cool information in here, but the guy's kind of a jerk, and I think that's why I found this book at the dollar store. He says in here, "Interesting enough, out of all the internet law-related books I've seen, I've recognized few of the authors. Obviously, someone doesn't have to be recognized by me to know a good deal about this area of law. I just find it odd that in all these years, I've not run into them in some significant way." You know, this guy seems to think that if he doesn't know you, you don't know anything. So, but he does have some good information in the book. I can let you look at it. Maybe you can find what you're looking for. But on the First Amendment, some of the myths about the First Amendment, like, you have a right to free speech guaranteed by the First Amendment, but the Supreme Court has determined that not all speech is created equal. And I'm sure you've all heard the fire in a crowded theater analogy. That's that you have a right to free speech, but you can't yell fire in a crowded theater, and the addendum to that is without paying the consequences. There's commercial speech. There are different tests for free speech and restrictions on free speech. And commercial speech is afforded less protection than speech that criticizes the government. Like, the highest level of protection is supposed to be for speech that criticizes the government, because that's the intent of the First Amendment. And that gets strict scrutiny. And in order to restrict that kind of speech, the government, and also it has to be government action. The First Amendment says the Congress shall make no law. And so, you know, your sister telling you to shut up is not you don't have a First Amendment right to prevent your sister from saying, "Shut up, you stupid little brother," or whatever. So it's government action. There are different levels of scrutiny that are applied. Are you going to let me know when the speaker is here? Okay. And the commercial speech has a lower test than the strict scrutiny test. And in order to restrict commercial speech, the government has to prove that they have a legitimate government interest and that there is not a less restrictive means of restricting that speech. So, and then there's other speech that has even lower protection, which is like the obscenity law says, it's not a law, it's common law, but the obscenity one is that if the speech doesn't have any redeeming social value, then, and it violates the community standard for, it's basically based on your community, would they find that obscene, then you really don't have protection for that either. So they're all different kinds of tests that the Supreme Court will apply when they're looking at a freedom of speech issue. There's also the whole interplay with the intellectual property laws and the patents and the copyrights. They've said that you can patent an algorithm. Originally, they had said that math is something that you can't patent math, because they say it exists as part of nature and it's discovered, it's not created. So you can't patent math, but you can patent an algorithm. And so, okay, is the speaker here now? All right. Yeah.
You mentioned common law. Can you give a 3-sentence overview of what rights apply under common law, or how common law came into existence, and why we might want to be interested in it?
Our legal system is based on the English legal system. So there's basically two kinds of law. One is law created by the legislature, but law created by initiative process by the people is also counted as legislative law, and that's statutory law, and they're codified as statutes. So the U.S. Code, your state criminal laws, those are statutory laws. And the courts have what's known as common law. The Supreme Court gets to interpret the laws, but they also have what's known as precedent. That's another thing I heard somebody say yesterday. Statutes don't look to precedent. When there's a new statute, It is, and it replaces anything that went before it that contradicts it. So it's the most recent one is the valid one. With common law, it's kind of the opposite. They have a doctrine called stare decisis. It looks backwards. And so if there's a precedent saying, you know, X is the interpretation of this law, then the only people who can overturn that is the Supreme Court, either if it's interpreting the Constitution or the federal law, that would be the Supreme Court, or if it's interpreting state law or the state constitution, it's the state courts that have the power to interpret those laws. And so when they talk about common law, like there's common law for copyrights that's different from the federal law, and in some, the states are allowed to make their own copyright laws, so you can have state common law, copyright law that is more protective. It can't be less protective, but it can be more protective of the creator's rights than the federal law. And I think my time's up, and the next speaker is here. So if you have more questions about that or anything else, I'd be happy to talk to you out in the lobby.
I just have one question about intellectual property.
Yeah?
Good.
Well, that kind of a...
Especially if he was drunk when he made the statement.
Yeah. Real drunk.
The best answer I have for that is... I don't really know the answer to that question, but I know that there's a recent California state case that said that professors' lectures are protected intellectual property and that you can't tape them and you can't share them with other students. So although states don't follow other states' common law because they're different jurisdictions, if it's a case of first impression, which means they've never dealt with that issue before, they'll often look to other states to see what they've done, and a lot of people look to California for that kind of thing. And so it's possible that you would have intellectual property rights in your speech, especially if you had fixed it in any media beforehand. Your copyright, the instant of creation of the copyright is when it's fixed in permanent media. So when you blurt out an idea, you lose your rights to it if you haven't written it down beforehand or somehow fixed it, tape recorded it yourself. That's called, my teacher called that the blurt out rule. Like, if you have this great idea for a patent, and you can't wait, you just kind of blurt it out to all your friends, they if they write it down first, they now own it. So it just depends on if you wrote down your speech first or not, I guess. Or ask a lawyer, because that's just my opinion.